This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second half of our interview with Mary Tyler Moore. She's written her autobiography. The Dick Van Dyke Show and the Mary Tyler Moore Show are still going strong on Nick at Night, and now Moore is co-starring on the new CBS series New York News. In the first part of our show, we talked about breaking into show business and co-starring in the Dick Van Dyke Show. We begin the second part with a look back on the Mary Tyler Moore Show and the characters that Mary Richards worked with in the newsroom. The character of Ted Baxter was originally conceived as being someone of your age.
Right.
And there might be some, like, romantic attraction between you.
Exactly. He was probably going to be tall, dark, and handsome. And instead, what walked through the door was Ted Knight. Short, white-haired, and handsome, yes, but not what you'd call a love interest. But the writers, the writer-producers, Jim and Alan, were so open. And I think that's an important part of being a successful artist is being open to new ideas and input. And they saw this man and they began to think potential. All right, so it isn't our original idea, but oh, wow, look and feel and salivate over all the juicy stories we could do in another direction. And that's what happened. And they cast Ted.
What won them over? Was that big pretentious voice part of it?
You know, there was another thing that won them over. It wasn't just the fact that he was pomposity to the nth degree, but that there was a vulnerability and a sweetness to Ted. We found out later that Ted, who was a more out-of-work than in-work actor, had gone out and bought himself a blue blazer and a crest and had it sewn on the pocket so that he would look the part. And everybody just thought that was, you know, real throat-clenching stuff. And, you know, if there had been any doubt about whether or not he was the right one, that clinched it.
You write in your book that later into the series, Ted Knight wept because people thought he was really stupid.
Yeah.
They confused him so much with the character.
Yes, I don't remember exactly what year it was. I think it might have been the second year. I think it was the first year. And he was so successful. I mean, he was a unique character. No one had ever seen anybody like him as a continuing role in a series. And people were mistaking him for the character he played, which is so often true for those of us in television. And they would, and of course, both the first name was the same, Ted. And they were calling him stupid and, oh, you're the funniest dumbbell we ever met, and boy, are you dumb and stupid, and somebody called him a dumb schmuck, and he came into Jim Brooks and Alan Burns' office. Actually, it was only Alan in the office this day, and he was unable to speak. He was just sobbing, and apparently it had just spilled over at that particular moment. He said, I can't go on. I can't do this. I am a dignified man. I have standards, and I am proud, and I'm well-read, and everybody thinks I'm stupid. And so Alan pulled out all the stops and reminded him of all the great clowns in history who were cerebral and admired and who did great works in life by not only the good works themselves, but by making fools of themselves, by pratfalling, by doing all the dumb things that make people think you're dumb. And he was pretty much convinced and on his way out of the door when Jim Brooks came in and said, ah, Ted, the world's favorite schmuck.
Oops.
But he had a sense of humor about it, and he got it out of his system. I think that's all he needed to do. I think, you know, that's probably all a lot of us need to do on many occasions of frustration is just say it, get it out, and sort of let the steam out, you know, let the top of the kettle off for a minute.
I think one of the real famous moments in television openings, and one of the famous freeze frames is you throwing your hat in the air in the opening of the show with the
right.
Jingle underneath.
Yeah.
Do you remember that moment?
Oh, do I? It was freezing cold. It was in Minneapolis in January, I think, or February. And we didn't know what we were doing. We were just there to grab a lot of footage that shows a young woman's exuberance, being in a new city, looking around, gazing at the sights. And I had in my hand a hat, a little beret that my aunt had given me for Christmas. And I had packed that along with whatever other warm things that I had, which weren't too many because I was a Californian, to go to Minneapolis to do these film spots. And Jim Brooks said, "Oh, I have a good idea, Bering. Take that hat, put it on your head, and now run into the intersection, and it'll be all right. We'll watch for cars." And throw it up in the air as if to say, "This is my town, and I'm celebrating my life that is taking place." And I did it, and luckily, magically, wasn't hit by a car, although I got some pretty strange looks. And in fact, I guess it must be in every episode, you can see this one woman in the background who looks at me as if not only am I the world's strangest person, but that she would like to personally lock me up. But it's interesting, isn't it, that something that becomes burned in people's impressions and memories can happen so happenstancely out of nowhere. It wasn't written. It was just a spur-of-the-moment idea.
So that traffic was the real thing.
Oh, yeah, it was. And it's a good thing I didn't have to speak any lines because my lips weren't working. It was so cold. I literally could not form words.
Huh. Mary Tyler Moore is my guest. She's written a new autobiography called After All. I have a colleague here who said, "The Mary Tyler Moore Show made me who I am today, single." And I thought that was particularly funny because, you know, all those years you were playing Mary Tyler Moore, you had no idea what it was like to be single. You got married as soon as you got out of high school. You divorced, but you were only single for about 6 months before marrying Grant Tinker.
That's right. Boy, you've read the book, haven't you?
Yes.
Yes.
So really, you'd never lived that kind of single life.
No, I hadn't. And when Grant and I finally ended our marriage and I went to New York to do a Broadway play, Whose Life Is It Anyway?, I decided to stay in New York and try to capture my life for myself. I had never been on my own. I had never experienced any of the situations that Mary Richards had lived for the rest of the world every week. And I set about to make that happen for myself. I dated, I made friends, I had a little apartment, I did my own shopping and schlepped my own clothes to the dry cleaner and back and the laundry and all of that stuff. And I sort of generally played house. But in real life.
I'm interested in hearing a little bit about your own family when you were growing up, since after all, you know, you portrayed one of the most famous couples on television on the Dick Van Dyke Show, and then had a wonderful family of friends and colleagues.
Yes.
On the Mary Tyler Moore Show. When you were growing up, your own family was probably what we'd now call dysfunctional.
Yeah, I suppose so. It's an overused phrase, and I wish we could be a little more specific about it.
I agree.
I didn't mean to criticize you for that.
No, I didn't take it that way.
my mother and father were very much the couple that Grant Tinker and I became. They say that you do follow the patterns that you grow up in, and this was certainly true in my case. WASP, repressed, unable to deal with things that are uncomfortable, pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, not discussing anything that's ugly or unpleasant, and just muddling through. A little of Beth Jarrett in Ordinary People came from those people, from myself. And I emulated that with Grant Tinker. My father is a very well-educated intellectual, a lover of classical music and classical literature. My mother was an English major, and everything was just perfect in that house, but nobody was talking to anybody.
Well, another thing that was less than perfect is your mother drank.
My mother was an alcoholic, as I was to become. Her alcoholism took another form from mine. She would, by the dint of determination, be sober for months at a time and then be unable to continue. And all of the problems that had been building up and she had been stuffing under the rug of her emotions would burst forth, and she would start drinking in the day, and she would not stop until somebody found the bottle and took it away and pretty much held her captive in the house until she sobered up and we were able to plead with her to stop, and then she would try again. Back then, nobody knew what we know about alcoholism today, and and the kind of counseling it takes and the kind of sharing and support that is needed to get through this, to break this cycle. They feel now, I think most scientists agree, that there is a genetic predisposition to alcohol, which in combination with other factors in life is going to almost guarantee some form of dependency in later life. My form of alcoholism was much more controlled because I grew up in that very uncomfortable, very sad situation, and I determined that I was never going to do that, never be drunk. And I probably never was really out and out drunk, and I certainly never drank during the daytime. But I wasted a lot of my time, and I forgot a lot because I didn't remember much of what had happened the night before. I got out of proportion angry about things that were really unimportant, but that's what alcohol does to you.
My guest is Mary Tyler Moore. She's written her autobiography. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mary Tyler Moore. Did being an actress help you be able to drink and not show the signs of it? Help you cover it up?
Maybe so. I don't think so, though, because once your speech is slurred, once you lose balance, there's no way you can pretend that away. But I paced myself. I never allowed myself to drink any more than the company I was with. And that way nobody could judge me, nobody could see.
Did you drink alone?
Yeah, I did, but I was seldom alone, except when I moved to New York. And then I was alone, and then my drinking really escalated. Mm-hmm. And I found myself not going out after 5 o'clock and making sure that everything was set up for me to have my dinner there on the bed that was by the air conditioner, that was near the phone, that was near the television set, and that I had my blender full of drinks that I was concocting in an attempt to do something worthwhile in the kitchen. And it was a pretty sad lady that was emerging.
Were you afraid that the press would find out that you drank a lot, and it would be
no,
this
because
whole thing. Yeah.
I didn't think I drank a lot.
Oh, I see.
That's the amazing part of it.
Uh-huh.
Most alcoholics are in such a state of denial about their condition. They will blame everything but themselves for whatever is going on. I didn't have hangovers per se, but I found that it was getting very difficult to hold the eyeliner brush steady when I was applying my makeup in the morning. So I thought, I guess that's just something that happens when you enter your 40s, and it's a nerve-wracking city, so I'll just have to, take a little more time with it or use a thinner brush, whatever. And I had nobody to point out to me the lack of sense that I was making and the deterioration of my thinking.
You stopped drinking, I think it was, the mid-80s?
It was 11 years ago, yeah, I guess. That was the mid-80s, yes. 86?
You did Betty Ford.
Right.
Do you think your emotional character changed after you stopped drinking?
Oh, there's no question about it. In a way, I sometimes feel grateful that I did have this alcoholism. Except that there were so many sad events that were caused by it that I can't wholeheartedly say that. But at least it got me to the Betty Ford Center, where I was able to, with the help of some counselors and a lot of group therapy sessions, examine myself and the way I handled my life and the way I handled problems and the way I reacted to any given situation, and was able to make major changes. I allowed myself to be imperfect. I allowed myself to make mistakes and laugh at it, to handle my real-life mistakes the way I handled the acting mistakes on the Dick Van Dyke Show, to think of those as positive steps forward rather than anything to be ashamed of.
One of the movies that you've made over the years is Change of Habit, which is an Elvis film in which he plays a doctor in the ghetto.
And he plays a singing surgeon. And I play a nun.
A plainclothes nun.
A plainclothes nun who's out of the habit. And it was a story about these two dedicated social workers who come together in the ghetto to bring about goodness to all mankind.
But you start to fall in love, and at the end you must choose between God and Elvis.
Right, and you see a shot of me in church looking from the Jesus, the statue of Jesus, and Elvis playing guitar, and then to Jesus and Elvis and Jesus and Elvis and Jesus and Elvis, and you never know at the end who I finally chose. I was Elvis's last leading lady. And he apparently said in somebody's book, he is quoted in somebody's book as having said, there's only one leading lady that I didn't sleep with. And guess what? I know who she is.
Right. So what was it like to play opposite him?
It was wonderful, and he was nothing like the image that that a lot of us have about him back then. Gosh, what was the year? I don't know, maybe 67 or 68, something like that. He was in great shape, and he was working out, and he was watching his diet, and he was living a good life. I mean, yes, there were a lot of ladies in and out of his trailer, but he was sweet and wholesome, and he knew his dialogue, and he had done his homework, and he was he had a big crush on me from the Dick Van Dyke Show, but, you know, in a reserved, from a distance kind of way. If he didn't watch himself, he'd call me ma'am, and he was very shy and kind of awkward with me.
Now, this was hardly the film that either you or Elvis became best known for.
Right. I think it's better said that we triumphed over. In spite of this film, we continued.
Now, did you regret making the film as it was being made? Did you have a sense that this was not going?
Oh, no. I didn't know what I was doing at that time. Movies were new to me, and, you know, they may have not felt as well written and directed as the television shows that I had been involved in, but I thought, well, see, that's the difference in the medium. You know, this is a movie, and so they know what they're doing. And as it turned out, they didn't. But it's all right. Now, I really don't regret anything that I've done in terms of my work. If I were writing a happily ever after piece, looking back, sure, there are things that would probably be better if they were erased and maybe not included at all. But I think I've learned from everything I've done, and I can't help but bring those experiences to what I do today.
Mary Tyler Moore, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it, Terry. It's like talking with a pal.
Mary Tyler Moore has written a new autobiography called After All. You can see her on Nick at Night as Laura Petrie and Mary Richards, and you can see her on CBS in her new series, New York News. This is Fresh Air.